Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwane aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 134.
PL timestamp, day 2016.
Actual chemistry lecture this morning. The newcomer should probably at least try to attend. It's not relying on math from Keltham's earlier lectures. This is the periodic table of elements. It's ordered by protons and organized by the arrangement of electrons as they fill up the least energetic orbital positions. Keltham will spend much longer this time describing the electron orbitals and how covalent bonds allow shared electrons to fill more of their shells, and how this lower potential energy state, where more electrons are closer to stronger attractive charges of protons, makes molecules tightly bound together in a way that takes heat to pry apart. When you could, in principle, rearrange all the atoms in a reaction into a lower energy state at the end, releasing heat along the way, it implies a potential more stable state the system might get into and stay in afterwards. To get there, you need a high temperature so that the vibrations of heat will break apart some of the original molecules and let them randomly recombine, sometimes into the lower energy state. Ideally, you pick a reaction temperature that easily breaks apart the feed molecules, but doesn't so easily break apart the more tightly bound final forms. The reaction they're trying for with sulfuric acid is, stage 1, burn sulfur to sulfur dioxide. This is exothermic, but requires a high starting temperature. Sulfur plus oxygen yields sulfur dioxide. Stage 1.5, purify the sulfur dioxide. Keltham doesn't actually remember how to do this, unfortunately. Stage 2, catalyze sulfur dioxide to sulfur trioxide, in the presence of oxygen, using element 23 oxide as a catalyst. Sulfur dioxide plus vanadium pentoxide yields sulfur trioxide plus vanadium tetroxide, probably. Maybe sulfur dioxide plus vanadium tetroxide yields sulfur trioxide plus vanadium trioxide, and then vanadium trioxide plus oxygen equals vanadium pentoxide. Stage 3, cool and dissolve the sulfur trioxide in sulfuric acid to form oleum. Sulfuric acid plus sulfur trioxide yields pyrosulfuric acid. Stage 4, react oleum with water to form concentrated sulfuric acid, twice as much as previously existed. Pyrosulfuric acid plus water yields 2 molecules of sulfuric acid. He's not really sure about the details in the case of the sulfuric acid synthesis pathway, but a reason the vanadium catalyst might help in the first place is if it's relatively hard to tear apart an oxygen molecule, for example, and the exergic reaction of a single sulfur dioxide to sulfur trioxide isn't enough. Pull to tear apart a single oxygen molecule. It could happen with 2 sulfur dioxide molecules at once, cooperating to tear apart an oxygen molecule that's already heated and vibrating, but then it's less likely for all those molecules to be in the right positions. But vanadium pentoxide could resist the tug more weakly, giving up an oxygen molecule to a demanding sulfur dioxide molecule, and then giving up another oxygen molecule and turning into vanadium trioxide, and then swallowing down a whole oxygen molecule to go back to vanadium pentoxide again. Possibly. For example, the main point of this process, as Keltham understands it, is that it's liable to produce relatively high purity sulfuric acid at scale. It will also, he suspects, be much easier to do, much easier to do reliably, if they can learn to really use prestidigitation. Prestidigitation can alter color, taste, stickiness. Keltham has now verified that prestidigitation can modify acidity and basicness in order to modify the reaction of vinegar with wood ash, lye. He's previously verified that prestidigitation can produce temporary magnetism, but only for so long as Keltham is concentrating, and even that he can get a material to reject a magnetic field using prestidigitation. All of this is of a kind with the shapes of the electron orbitals, the potential energy surfaces that determine possible reactions and reaction rates. Prestidigitation should definitely be a sort of thing that can break the rules of chemistry. They can maybe make element 20 calcium behave like element 23 vanadium, for purposes of turning it into something that behaves like vanadium oxide, without Keltham needing to somehow figure out which Galarian metal is vanadium. Though vanadium oxide is donating oxygen molecules within the chemical reaction, so the oxygen part ought to be real. There could maybe be a way to directly prestidigitate sulfur dioxide to quickly react with oxygen at high temperatures and turn into sulfur trioxide without need of a vanadium catalyst if they really knew what they were doing. There may be, conceptually speaking, something sulfur dioxide could taste like, which would make it react more easily with oxygen and slide down the exothermic gradient to sulfur trioxide. Keltham is guessing that energy is probably conserved even in the presence of prestidigitation, which means that they probably can't do very much work of a form, make this very tight binding loose, because it should properly take energy to shake loose of a binding like that. But even small changes at the potential energy surfaces can do a lot to eliminate reaction barriers, though there's already hints that you need to be able to sort of understand that stuff or visualize it on some level to get prestidigitation to know what it is you want it to do. How are people doing on that?
How should they be visualizing electrons and orbitals? Are these tiny beads on strings?
Keltham's not sure how far they're going to have to go into law to get prestidigitation working for them. Layer 1. There's tiny little point-like particles called electrons, with left charge being pulled towards nuclei with right charge. Identical electrons can't be in the same place at the same time, so there's only so much room for electrons to crowd around each other as they get closer to a nucleus. Actually, electrons can only be at certain exact distances from nuclei for reasons. So there's only so many orbitals for them to live in. The lowest distance can only contain 2 electrons. Atoms with more protons, like element 8, oxygen, are strongly electron-stealing or electronegative, and tend to tear away electrons from weaker nuclei, like element 4, beryllium. The electrons are still shared, still orbiting around everywhere, but you'll find more of them around the oxygen nucleus and less around the beryllium nucleus, which in turn will make the oxygen side of beryllium oxide more left-charged, since it's got fewer protons than electrons, since the electrons are crowding around the part with more protons to attract them, and the beryllium side more right-charged. This means that beryllium oxide is liable to go forming crystals in which the beryllium right sides of one molecule can get closer to the left oxygen parts of another molecule, and the crystal structure will have its own strength, though not as strong as the underlying molecules, which is why it's easier to break substances with a hammer than transmute them. If knowing layer 1 is enough to get prestidigitation working, everyone's lives will be a lot simpler. Layer 2 is about why 2 electrons can fit into the lowest orbital. It's because they need to have different states, and there's only 2 possible states. Similarly, the next shell out that can contain up to 8 electrons is actually 2 possible states of one kind of orbit and 6 different possible kinds of another orbit. The electrons have magnetism going on, and there's a way that electric charges and magnetic fields have a nature that fits together. A wave that propagates through the coupled electric and magnetic fields is a photon. When you have a lot of photons together, that's light. Layer 3 is that the electrons aren't actually point-like particles moving around. They're clouds of complex numbers with an equation that propagates the cloud. And the reason electrons can only orbit in certain distances and patterns is that their waves would interfere and cancel each other out otherwise. This is the point at which you could start to calculate where the orbitals go, though that's rapidly going to get harder for anything beyond 1 electron orbiting 1 proton. Layer 4 is learning what the clouds are made of and starts to get into underlying reality fluids and anthropics.
Hopefully that doesn't turn out to be necessary for prestidigitation.
Actually, she kind of hopes that it does. Then they'd know what anthropics are.
We can hope. Hope is cheap since it doesn't affect actual outcomes. Keltham hung a silent image earlier today. Here's what sulfuric acid actually looks like. You can see how those dangling hydrogen atoms on the end could potentially be ripped loose from the electrons holding them in, repelled by the positive charges at the center, and go off as positively charged protons to mess around with other chemical bonds and break them and dissolve them, which is what makes an acid acidic. Here's what electron orbitals actually look like. Protons are heavy and right-charged and clumped together by more powerful forces into nuclei, despite the repulsion of similar charges. Electrons are left lighter and cloud-like, attracted to protons, self-repelling, and no two of them can be in the same place at the same time, with the same... The heavy protonic nuclei settle into a configuration of least energy, taking into account the attractive electron charges and that the protonic nuclei repel each other insofar as not electron neutralized. The heavy protonic nuclei act as a sort of backbone for the light electron cloud. It's actually less complicated than the weird, twisted interactions found in hanging spells, in some ways. There's a lot fewer interactions, really. It's just that these are different interactions, and the math is a tad deeper than any individual force described in Second Circle Wizard textbooks. Also, they can't just manually manipulate the forces. They've got to subtly influence them, with prestidigitation, to make bulk chemical interactions go differently. Also, nobody's ever done anything like this before, so far as Keltham knows. So they're going to have to try a lot of stuff, and it's not actually clear which level of understanding is going to be required to do what. After lunch, it'll be time for more experimentation, using various things Keltham requested, using cheap materials he could identify, that will chemically react in ways that Keltham knows about. Can they, for example, alter various substances, so that when plunged into a hot fire, they burn with a different color of flame? Not alter the flame's color directly, prestidigitate the material so that it burns with a different color when lit. That's a fairly direct test of their ability to mess with orbitals and potentials. It's electrons moving between orbitals that emit light of a particular energy, and hence color. Are they ready to get a lot of identical no answers to, did that work? While carefully observing for signs that anything observable went even slightly differently.
That is actually the kind of thing Chellish Wizard Education prepares you for unusually well.
A fair number of people are now trying incredibly hard to be the fastest to figure it out.
Well, so is Keltham. It doesn't matter how unfair the competition is. He's still competing.
And yes, Keltham is first to prestidigitate materials to burn with different colors of light. Yay, if he was feeling competitive about that.
Feeling competitive is beneath Lady Avaricia, but winning is not. She studied under an alchemist. Her education has generally been more varied than that of the other students. And none of what Keltham said was that complicated. If you're not overawed by him, which she isn't, can she imagine this flame burns like salt even though it didn't? More complicated than that? Can she imagine it tastes like salt? Can she imagine what's going on in salt, what its electrons are doing, and... She doesn't get it as fast as Keltham, but she gets it.
Well, now he's actually interested in this county's heiress-type person. Everyone pause. Does Eulalia have any guesses for what she knows that the other students might not know?
I know all kinds of things they don't know, since they're peasants. Relevantly, I was thinking about how salt burns in different colors. Prestidigitation can be used to make food salty. That was insufficient.
What sufficed for you, if thinking about saltiness didn't do it?
I kept thinking about saltiness, but in more detail, about what structures salts form, what alchemical properties they have, how different salts make different colors, what specific salt I was pretending to burn.
Do you remember the last thing you thought before it worked?
That green would go better with my nails today, so I should burn copper.
He doesn't really get this person, but that's fine on a level where Keltham hardly even notices it. Dathalan has lots of weirdos. Huh. All right. Time to slow down in at least that section and do slightly less maniacal experimentation. Let's have you peel off somebody and try to teach them to do what you do, but note down what you're trying to teach them in what order. Any tier ones want to volunteer for that?
Sure. Otherwise, she'll be worrying about Lady Avaricia Asmodia or Lady Avaricia Ioni explosions.
Willa Shalira, Seeing Red, Deano. Willa had been trying to influence her prestidigitation with complicated math in her head, in the hopes it might be enough like real chemistry. Maybe unsurprisingly, it wasn't getting anywhere. A little while after Eulalia's comment, though, she decides it's time to escape her solution space. She gets out a copper and licks it. And now she has some green flames too, how about that? She immediately starts licking her other coins to try to branch out, but it seems to be harder going getting anything but green.
All right, somebody else should definitely just try that.
Doesn't work for Pilar.
Works for Asmodia.
Right, well, that's actually very encouraging in terms of being able to eventually figure out what's going on here. much more informative than everything just working reliably, when you think about it.
Sioikorva Talandria, ruin of souls, apprentice bard. Feeling competitive is not beneath Korva. If she isn't competitive with everyone else here about something that isn't math, she's pretty sure she's going to fail out of the project and possibly, in some important sense, kind of fail out of hell prestidigitation she can do, though. She doesn't want to copy the copper thing now that it's been done because it's much less impressive to be second at something. What other things burn weird colors that aren't green? Potash, she's pretty sure, but she doesn't know what potash is doing at the tiniest level other than that it's a kind of salt. Sulfur burns blue, she's pretty sure. And it's definitely a pure element because Keltham was talking about it. She's just gonna go for broke and try to directly simulate sulfur. Sulfur has a lot of prestidigitation-worthy traits, actually. It has a smell, a little like eggs, and she's seen it before, knows its texture and the shapes it forms and a few of the things it mixes with, knows that it makes some mildly poisonous smoke. After a few minutes of intense focus and blocking out everyone else, she gets a blue flame and then starts coughing.
Somebody hit her with a dispel magic and see if that immediately stops the coughing. He'll do a radius healing after that, and after any lingering smoke has had some time blow away.
It takes a little bit for her lungs to calm down again, but after that she seems fine. Sorry.
Giant positive healing energy burst. For what? You didn't kill yourself at all, let alone in an unusually expensive way. And I think we probably want to plow ahead and not be too cautious until the first really costly injury. Nice blue flame, by the way.
Keltham.
No, I'm sticking to theme on this one. Premature caution is expensive, slow, and not fun. We keep pushing until we find out what's actually dangerous. If we get through all of Project Lawful with zero experimental fatalities, it means we were being much too safe.
Korva personally thinks that dying prematurely sounds way, way, way less fun than being the level of cautious that it takes to avoid that. Actually, it sounds terrifying. She barely knows anything yet. So there's no actual reason to resurrect her, which means she would be stuck in hell not having made adequate use of her time as a mortal, which might mean an extremely boring eternity as a paving stone when compared to all of the people who actually got a head start on making something of themselves. Obviously, this just means that she's going to have to look out for her own safety, though, since it isn't remotely reasonable to expect Keltham to look out for it. Finding his assistants' lives expendable is really perfectly par for the course for the sort of person that he seems to be. She's a little baffled by the claim that he isn't evil yet, though. She'll just nod.
Keltham has all the best opinions. Needless fretting about possible grisly death would probably make this so much slower and also less fun. She is game to race ahead, licking stuff and making fire until some of it blows up in her face, and then to race ahead some more.
And just to clarify explicitly, any casualties get resurrected. Even people who have not yet signed contracts with Project Lawful, who are second circle wizards, who Cheliax couldn't afford to resurrect as a matter of routine, especially not during a war. Yes?
Yes. Would anyone have seriously thought?
Not everyone had a nice, comfortable life before coming to this fortress, Keltham.
Fair. I stand corrected.
She really needs to figure out whether or not this is a sex thing for her at some point.
Quietly, but not too quietly, it's a conversation they could have in Alter. Cheliax, the version of it reserved for real. Cheliax would happen at night. It cannot possibly come as a surprise to you that no one likes you and that most people remember you as an obnoxious stereotype.
No one ever remembers anyone else as more than a vague stereotype, unless you've attracted wildly more of their attention than is smart.
So, you want people to assume you're frivolous and obnoxious since they'll round you off to something and it's not particularly dangerous?
Oh no, I am frivolous and obnoxious.
In Alter Cheliax, she wouldn't light this person on fire. She probably wouldn't even be tempted.
I think there's a Dathalani way of looking at it, actually. If you like that better. If it allows you to feel like your vague sense that I'm more important and better than you've accounted for is grounded in something. People who have better sense motive than bluff don't choose what to claim. They choose how to be.
I don't have a vague sense you're better and more important than you're pretending to be. I have a vague sense that you're not doing something that makes sense to me, and that's a threat to my project.
Huh. I am better and more important than I'm pretending to be. Do you want me to walk you through what should have tipped you off?
I'd be delighted.
She counts them off on her fingertips. It took me most of the last 2 days to decorate my room, until living in such privation would not impair me, and I still finished the transcripts and associated exercises faster than most of the students who don't have some kind of disability, where they repurposed all their brains for math and can't use any of it for anything else. I attended every one of Asmodia's lectures, and despite the fact she is an idiot child, in shoes far too big for her. She had no complaints for you about me. Salts are pairings of elements on opposite sides of Keltham's periodic table, the possibility of which I looked for as soon as he introduced it, because of the alchemical teaching that every salt is in two parts, and that's why they dissolve in water so readily. Your outfit isn't bespoke, and it's nice enough, it ought to be. I'm surprised that tailor let you walk out of the shop with it fitting so poorly. I suspect they spent the rest of the week agonizing over whether they were going to get in trouble with their superiors for letting you walk out like that, or if they'd have gotten into more for trying to have you stay when you were evidently in a hurry. I didn't see you at the palace, but I have a friend who did, and that's how she knew that you'd been important for less than a week, with the timing matching Nadal rather neatly. It's always hard to know if peasants get subtext, but she thinks everything crucial must have gotten through there.
Sometime later.
And that's about all the experimentation he's got in him for today. Keltham finds today's results very encouraging. There were a lot of bizarre phenomena that nobody understood, but not a steady stream of yes or no either. With that amount of variation, there's going to be all kinds of handles they can use to find hypotheses that compress these mysterious details. Also, they actually did manage to prestidigitate materials that would burn a different color. This is very encouraging, and strongly suggests that prestidigitation chemistry can in fact be a thing. The first target remains large-scale, high-purity sulfuric acid synthesis, which would all by itself noticeably contribute to bringing down spell silver costs, and can be considered as a prerequisite step to trying to refine spell silver out of less costly ores. Keltham has left behind some descriptions of common chemical reactions made with identifiable materials. He suspects he may end up taking a slower day tomorrow, and has other things to do today. People could, only if they genuinely actually have the spare time and energy, and don't need time off more. Try to experiment with measuring the reaction rates of known reactions. And, if they can measure those rates precisely enough to make it worth it, check to see if they can make particular reaction pathways happen faster, slower, more reliably, that sort of thing. It'll probably be easier to make flames that burn cooler rather than hotter, but that's only an informed conjecture. Oh yeah, temperature. Keltham is still trying to figure out how to build a thermometer. The last attempt exploded and was sort of a stupid idea anyways. That part's actually sort of important. They'll be doing a lot of temperature measuring. More precise measurements mean consuming less material inputs to generate effects large enough to notice. There doesn't happen to be a measure temperature spell, does there?
There does not. Alchemists use mercury.
Somebody want to explain what mercury is? Okay, wow, that sounds like element 80, and maybe that stuff is safe to be around if restoration works against it, but Keltham wants to poison some mice with it and make sure restoration actually works there. Element 80 has a horrific safety rep in Dathilan, because at least in Dathilan, it's incredibly hard to get out of a person once it gets into them. If restoration works, to let mercury-poisoned mice lead otherwise productive and happy mouse lives, maybe they'll risk it. But it might take a little time to be sure of that, unless it's already a known fact that a restoration gets rid of all the sickness. Possibly insanity. Keltham doesn't remember if Element 80 was one of those. That would otherwise be caused by Element 80 poisoning.
Restoration heals damage. Neutralize poison prevents further damage. Possibly there are subtle long-term effects. It's not like anyone would have checked. Alchemists are kind of crazy.
Okay, but what do the survey studies show about the causal structure of... rephrase. Were they crazy before they became alchemists? And if they die and come back, are they suddenly less crazy? More importantly, does anybody in Galarian actually have any reliable knowledge about anything in this subject area?
No. You just kind of hear, you know, stories about crazy alchemists. It's not like anyone went and talked to all the alchemists about their craziness histories. The first one would melt you with an acid bomb when you knocked on their door.
Why is his life like this? All right. You know what? What Keltham is actually going to do here is file an actual request for this query to get routed to actually knowledgeable people ASAP, because it is possible that definite knowledge exists here, even if nobody on this project is specialized for it. Thermometers that won't irrevocably poison you and drive you mad are in fact an important requisite of chemistry. Not to mention, with all of magic and all of physics to work with, you'd really think there'd be something with a measurable linear dependence on temperature that was not the density of mercury. Like, seriously, maybe he can build a resistance thermometer and calibrate it off a mercury one? Though resistance thermometers probably don't work at, like, another 10 times the temperature distance between frozen water and boiling water, such as you need for metallurgy. Actually, Keltham would be sort of surprised if the element 80 thermometers worked for that either. Anyways, this was in fact an encouraging day, and an encouraging set of results, full of detailed surprises to make hypotheses about. Good afternoon, everyone. Enjoy whatever it is you do when Keltham isn't watching. Maybe an hour or so later, Keltham shall summon his Carissa to his cuddle room.
Aw, man, she wanted to work on her glibness swords. This is slightly visible on her face when she's fetched, and Elias Abarco smirks at her, which it'd probably be unprofessional to light him on fire for. Not unprofessional to arrange for someone else to do it, though. Anyway, Carissa comes to the cuddle room. Carissa comes.
She'll be promptly stripped and chained to the bed, and only then, of course, will Keltham explain. Keltham is planning to start his Galarian martial arts practice, you see, and Keltham keeps forgetting to ask how wizards end up more resilient to damage, or for the six major theories thereof, which seems like an important sort of fact to know. It was established rather some time earlier that Keltham is only permitted to obtain this information by tickling it out of Carissa. He's just finally gotten around to remembering the question on some occasion when it is actually a good time to do that.
She pouts. It's not meant to be convincing distress, even to Keltham. Begging for mercy, allowed, or the same sort of thing as saying no and not allowed.
Not allowed. I don't want you trying to figure out exactly what doesn't sound like a request while being tickled, and I don't want to fight my own brain around any edge cases that slip through. Whoops, excuse me. My internal Abigail is telling me that was not the correct answer, and she kinda has a point. Ahem. Don't be ridiculous. You can obtain mercy by telling me about the six theories. Why would I want to hear anything else out of you?
Oh no, you have an inner Abigail. I should just surrender now. I won't, though.
Well, allow me to help align your actual behavior more closely with your sense of what it should be. Keltham will then actually output that behavior. His own sense of what he should do is not usually far off from what he does.
Carissa will hold out for a respectable bit of time, just out of principle.
Right, but what are the actual theories here? Keltham has a sort of wordless sense that only tickle torturing people for information you're genuinely curious about would be a sexual epistemic virtue, if Dathilan had already invented virtues about that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. Theory 1. Magic healing makes people tougher over time. This explains why combat veterans tend to get much tougher. The idea is that the healing does more than just fix you. This would imply that rich nobles are much tougher than normal people because they can get frivolous magic healing, and indeed they do tend to be. Theory 2. People are directly tougher in proportion to how powerful, important they are because the universe thinks that powerful people should be harder to hurt and kill. This one is out of favor because of how it treats the universe as something that decides that? Why would that be the case? Theory 3. In a normal person, the relationship between the soul and the body is of a particular character, like the soul is a cloak worn by the body. Some kinds of uses of magic or spells cast on the person or exercises of power draw the soul closer to the body and make the person tougher. Theory 4. God treaties have most people weak and easy to kill, but people who are particularly important harder to kill because this makes the future less noisy and more predictable, which is no longer relevant because of foresight. Theory 5. There's an underlying factor of selfhood that affects the strength of your alignment aura, how hard you are to kill, and how hard it is to affect you with certain magics. This is technically compatible with the soul theory, but the proponents hate each other. Theory 6. This is actually just one powerful wizard she put up with once in order to get some spells off him, but he thought that just as combat and adrenaline make you able to channel more magic, they make you internally channel more vital essence, which is what makes people healthy.
Okay, if this is the actual state of speculation, either Keltham is really missing something, or people in Galarian really don't science, or the correct answer is an info hazard getting buried. Theory 1 seems like it would be incredibly easy to test in opposition to the others by just taking a normal, unimportant kid and healing them once a day. Well, maybe you need to get hurt for the healing to count, but that test could at least rule out the version where regular healing does it without injury being needed first. And if the pilot experiment returned no on the added toughness, get one of the higher-grade masochists, or just use anesthesia, and test it with actual injuries on someone, starting after they were adults at age 13, and could sign up for an experiment? Do clerics who use 5 bursts of positive energy per day somewhere that needs the healing end up some of the toughest people around? If not, are any of those clerics masochists who could injure themselves first, or have their sadists do that before each healing? Does being incredibly rich make you tougher, as it would if it was just importance? Are there any famous cases of people losing all their money and then immediately losing the extra toughness? Did the girls on Project Lawful suddenly get much tougher once they were much more important? Should they get a dagger right now and test whether Keltham is important enough to have the extra toughness? Have they quantified strength of aura? Quantified how hard it is to do a standard amount of damage to a paid volunteer, and checked whether aura strength looks directly proportional to extra toughness? How can people possibly not already know whether some of these theories are true or false? Keltham won't explicitly mention his suspicion about the correct answer being a buried info hazard, but will ask Carissa about the obvious tests or checks on the other theories, flexing his tickling fingers in a threatening way as he does.
If anyone has done most of those experiments, they haven't advertised the results. Clerics are tougher than average, but not 5 times tougher than other people with similar careers. But they mostly do not self-injure before doing a healing surge, and I don't know anyone who has tried it. If it goes by importance, it's not in a you-immediately-become-tougher-when-you-get-a-promotion way. Notably, it's at least a little tricky to tell how tough people are, and it does vary a lot, even among wizards of the same circle, unlike strength of aura, which goes directly by caster circle. Keltham probably is hard to injure, she'd expect. She agrees that none of this is how civilization would explore the question. It's pretty normal for questions here.
Right. He lets Carissa out of the chains. They're going to go test right now how difficult Keltham is to injure. He's had practically no healing that involved injuries, has probably had a relatively very small amount of healing compared to other clerics, just from channeling like 7 or 8 total energy bursts, and is incredibly important to multiple gods crowded around his project like enormous light-drawn moths. Some of these theories die today, as in the next 5 minutes. Galarian is presumably just bad at disseminating information, or is deliberately keeping a secret, because native INT-20s with +6 intelligence headbands cannot possibly be this silly.
It's not impossible someone knows, but really, everything is like this. It's not confusing that it's like this.
I'm only not updating to conspiracy immediately, because I can't see why the conspiracy would be hiding that, and why they wouldn't have made up a more plausible state of confusion. And why their unfalsified theory set would be theories I could personally test within 5 minutes. What is wrong with this planet, if it even existed before I materialized here? How are we going to apply a standard amount of attempted injury? I'm thinking using standard weights to apply a measurable amount of force to a blade laid across my arm, but maybe you've got better ideas.
I have no idea how much a standard weight amount of force does to a blade laid across someone's arm, but sure? Or you could get the heating stone off Subirox again?
Nah, heating stone is too optimized for higher pain per unit injury. Though I'm going to be really amused in the case where the relative difference in our apparent pain tolerance was off by 4 bits because you were 16 times less damageable by the heating stone. To be clear, I'm not under the impression I'd have otherwise been able to compete. Man, I can visualize exactly the mechanism I want to set up here. To put a weight on top of a vertically held knife and push it downwards, but there's no snap-together pieces I could use to make it quickly. Oh hey, that spell you use to feed yourself grapes. Unseen Servant. Have you got one of those around or prepped that you're willing to use on this? And does it have a stable constant max power output that would be enough to injure yourself using a knife?
You can use an Unseen Servant to carry something that weighs less than 20 pounds, or shove along the ground something that weighs 100. It moves much slower than you'd want for a knife fight, but maybe that'd be fine for this?
What's an example of something that weighs 20 pounds that I know about? Or around how much do I weigh in 20-pound units? Or if you've got the servant running, you could just push on my hand that hard. I'm not actually totally clear on some of these precise units.
Sure, she will push on Keltham with all the force the Unseen Servant can muster.
Around 100 newtons, maybe? Or a bit less? That ought to injure an ordinary Dathilani if you put that much weight behind the edge of a kitchen knife. Never mind the point. Let's go grab a kitchen knife and try that. First on Keltham, then on Carissa, then maybe on Pilar if she's around. She's also a masochist, right?
Being around an important hypothesis that would be incredibly cheap to test, and hasn't been tested yet for a while, for no visible reason he understands, is making Keltham feel indignant. Or as close to indignant as most Dathilani ever get to that emotion. Neurotypical Dathilani don't usually feel that emotion as Galarian knows it, but what they'd feel around a long untested, cheaply testable hypothesis might come close. This is not how society is supposed to work. Not how people are supposed to act.
There's just so many of those. If you spent a while trying to stab yourself about all of them, you'd never do anything else. I have a dagger. You don't need to get one from the kitchens. It's in her bag of holding.
Right. Let's find Pilar, if she's willing, so that we can try this all at once and all get healed with one channeled surge.
Already here.
Great. Can I try stabbing you with a dagger for science? Healing will be provided afterwards, though I might ask you to wait for a half minute while Carissa and myself get stabbed too.
That sounds like something you could try, yes.
Great. Carissa, you're up. Let's try Pilar. You, myself, in that order, and see how much damage gets done before I heal it. Thigh seems like a relatively safer target. Edge first, then try the point if the edge doesn't penetrate.
If Keltham ever gets curious about the wrong thing, they're so doomed.
Keltham, Cleric 7, 32 GP, Carissa, Wizard 7, Cleric 1, 26 GP, and Pilar, Wizard 4, Oracle 4, 27 GP, seem to all be about as difficult to injure with a knife, which is notably a lot harder to injure than Keltham was a month ago.
Healing surge. Okay, that argues against toughness from healing, and shoots down my first meta-hypothesis about how the confused epistemic state was persisting. Which was that the extra toughness came from healing. And this truth was considered socially info-hazardous because rich people who wanted to be tougher would outbid poor, actually injured people, for cleric exposure. But then, why are rich people ending up harder to injure? Possibly the reason for the persistent confusion is that we've got multiple things going on. And if one of those things is still toughness via healing exposure, part of the confusion persistence could be info-hazard control too. So I guess I was actually jumping the gun on thinking that part out loud. Who do I check with about social info hazards? Broom, Aspexia, Lrilatha?
Prediction. Whether or not Broom knows, he'll tell you you don't need to. I'd ask Mylol to write Igorian, and then it can get escalated as needed by the Most High or Contessa Lrilatha's secretaries. I expect it's not an info hazard. I think you're assuming it is because it should be easy to tell, but high-level people who haven't had lots of magic healing are rare.
Nine. All right. I'll tell Mayol. Shit, Carissa, I'm sorry. If I'd known, I would have stabbed myself before I prayed to my deity, and then stabbed myself again before I tried my first healing surge. I didn't realize it was a kind of data that would be so hard to obtain. Keltham seems genuinely sad about this.
Of course he does. He had no way of knowing, but he accidentally wasted an irreplaceable scientific opportunity that could have contributed to settling a long-standing confusion in Galarian. What Dath Illani wouldn't apologise. He's not that selfish, nor blind to normal social norms.
Carissa has literally no idea what to say to this. It's okay? I'm not nearly as invested in this as you, honestly.
If I continue to stand around here, is anybody going to stab me again?
Wasn't currently planning to.
Pilar will head off then. Seems like their heretical safety officer ought to hear about this. Or to be more precise, Ione should hear about it from Pilar, so that Pilar can see any interesting expressions Ione makes.
Actually, this is now causing me to wonder if I would have otherwise been a lot more injured, even with the resist energy acid, by that exploding explosion of boiling liquid I was standing right next to. Might owe Ione a reluctant nod, there. On the plus side, less caution needed in future science experiments. Anyways, I wasn't expecting that result. I thought I was going to have to do something more elaborate before I started being slightly injury-resistant. But since I got the unexpectedly more convenient result, I'm going to go see about getting retaught martial arts by security until I've used up my 3 healing surges left on the day. Not private, if you want to watch. Though, what's your own martial arts level?
I'm a wizard. If I get into a hand-to-hand fight, something has already gone horribly wrong. In a fight, they've made some progress on planning the hypothetical escape. She snapcasts gaseous form.
He'll take a sudden unplanned step back and hold his breath inconveniently on an exhale. His mind goes to spells he could use as counters if Carissa is about to make a point by subduing him. But Keltham has stopped prepping spells like Sanctuary, so he's basically got nothing.
Rematerial Carissa. And then I'd leave. Best combat strategy is running away. You'll recall that when I couldn't run away because you were in danger, I did a destructive cancellation of my fly spell over the guy's head so I would break his neck when I fell on him.
Yeah, I remember. The security wizards probably have unarmed combat skills, though, right?
Yes, definitely. They're not supposed to run away, and they're supposed to be competent to do their job even if someone does an anti-magic field or something.
Okay, Dath Illani get, like, asymmetrical, unarmed combat training for emergencies only. Sequence 1, how to defend yourself from a single attacker, hopefully without injuring them. Trained in a way that does as little as possible to increase the combat potential of somebody misusing that skill for assault. Sequence 2, how to coordinate with at least 5 other people with the same training to immobilize somebody without them hurting themselves or you. I'm off to see security about retraining in that. Don't mind if you want to watch. Doubt you'll see much interesting or impressive on day 1, though.
I might go stab Pilar. I think you disappointed her.
Yeah, I got that vibe off her incredibly straight expression somehow. I don't even know how, but I did. Problem is, I don't have the kind of relationship with her that I have with you. I'd feel really odd about stabbing her if it wasn't in a scientific context. I don't think I'm ready to initiate a relationship with Pilar anyways. But even if I were, it sounds like I might need unarmed combat retraining to start one off correctly.
You know, yes, I think you might. All right, good luck with your unarmed combat training.
Right, well, let's go get a bit more psychologically acclimated to Galarian, then. Where do security wizards do martial arts practice around here?
They have their own barracks and a training yard beyond them.
Welp, Keltham's here for retraining. He's got 3 healing surges he can use on the day. Don't blow through them all at once. Specifics of required training lean towards physically subduing Carissa Sivar after disabling her magic in a surprise attack. They're not to mention this to Carissa. If anybody's wondering what's up with that, or if it's really okay, he's got a letter from Abigail Thrun about it.
That's terrifying. Oh, how romantic. Yes, they can absolutely teach that. If he's going to be mostly fighting with boosted strength, he should mostly train with boosted strength. It does change some tactics. Also, specialized non-combat clerics can convert unused spell slots to healing. If they just untie the spell instead of casting it, discharging all that positive energy.
Oh, interesting. That'll potentially get him through more rounds that require healing at the end, if he can do that. He's got a lot of truth spells just lying around. Also, is that kind of conversion less expensive to his god than if he does the whole channeled healing surge thing? He didn't actually queue up Bull's strength for today, or Cat's grace. Seems worth doing some training even if he doesn't. Current pain tolerance level. Managed to keep up. Detect magic for 1 minute with the heating stone. Took it off his arm maybe 18 seconds after that.
They've put some thought into the face Chelish security should show him. Obviously, they want him when he decides to escape to find it plausible he could overpower them if he got the jump on them. Probably they want to be substantially better than random civilians at hand-to-hand combat. But not actually all that scary when they can't spellcast. And probably lots of their combat skill is aimed at disrupting spellcasting, which they'll teach Keltham even if he plans to otherwise suppress his girlfriend's magic. They're happy to do this for as long as he wants to or has healing, and can call in a cleric for more healing after that if he wants.
Keltham's going to have weirdly over-optimized defensive skills if nobody puts a little effort into blowing through those. Conversely, his form is going to go hugely bad as soon as he tries to go on the offensive or grab anybody, leaving openings somebody could drive a truck-sized fist through. He's not going to find it particularly plausible if security wizards can't take him. Anybody with governance-level combat training should be able to take him. Anybody with the nearly mythical quality of having been in a real fight should be able to take him, which is why Keltham's so concerned about Carissa being able to take him even with her magic disabled.
Yeah, they didn't figure they could get away with security or complete amateurs, just security are possible to beat once you have some real combat training. Carissa probably could take him, in their professional assessment, just because she seems like the kind of person who's scary when cornered and who has been in some real fights. But that's fixable. It is the foundation of much of romance, that men are stronger than women and can beat them in a fight.
If men get the drop on women, disable their magic with a magic item used in a sneak attack, and have already cast physical enhancement spells on themselves, he's pretty sure a symmetrical attack by Carissa would work on Keltham, if everything about their relationship were completely different. The point of this isn't that he can beat Carissa in a fair fight. It's that he could and would do whatever it took to beat her unfairly. Beating her in a contest of physical strength is something that any physically specialized male could do, and that doesn't qualify random muscular guys to own her. Anyways, Keltham will go on trying to upgrade to having been in a real fight, until he's out of healing except for one unconverted truth spell, which seems like a natural time to stop. It's sort of weird, actually. He would have thought he'd want to be with Carissa after this, but his brain is saying Asmodia instead. Does she happen to have the time?
Actually, no, sure. Asmodia has totally been in her room studying this whole time, and was not doing very important conspiracy things just before then, and did not frantically run in here 10 seconds before Keltham arrived after his intended destination became clear. What's up?
He's been getting martial arts retraining from security, all healed now, but he's still feeling a bit psychologically worn. And for some odd reason, his brain returned an answer of Asmodia when queried for who he wanted to snuggle after that. Probably relatively quiet, going-to-sleep snuggles, if that's okay. He doesn't know if that's something that would interest her, and it's obviously okay to say no.
Sure. It's probably not quite the same as Keltham having been through a torture session and seeking her out afterwards. That, she feels instinctively, would be crazy high up on the Chelish relationship escalation scale. Like well past the point where the church arrests you for being in a relationship that healthy. But fuck it, she doesn't know. Whatever. Either the tropes have fated them to fall in love or they haven't.
He doesn't say much.
She holds a warm thing in her arms, big spoon to his little spoon this time, and wonders whether her future self will try to sabotage it all, if it starts looking like Keltham is actually heading towards hell. That's probably what being in love would mean, right?
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 7776059.